I'm now going to turn to out-of-body experiences in India. Now, this is going to throw a whole new perspective on out-of-body experiences. So, what do you suppose happens in India when someone has an out-of-body experience? Can anyone guess? What? He says the Yamadutas take him to Yamaraj. Now, what would you think such a thing might imply? Ah, cultural conditioning. It is a hallucination. Well, this is what happens in India. Let's see. I'll give you a case history. This is a man named Durga Jatav. We interviewed Durga Jatav, a man of approximately 50 years old, in November 1979, and again 3 months later. About 30 years before, he had been ill for several weeks, suffering from what had been diagnosed as typhoid. When his body became cold for a couple of hours, his family thought he had died. He revived, however, and later he told his family that he had been taken to another place by 10 people. He had tried to escape, but they had then cut off his legs at the knees to prevent his escape. He was taken to a place where there were tables and chairs and 40 or 50 people sitting. He recognized no one. They looked at his papers, saw that his name was not on their list, and said, "Why have you brought him here? Take him back." To this, Durga had replied, "How can I go back? I don't have feet." He was then shown several pairs of legs. He recognized his own, and they were somehow reattached. He was then sent back with the instructions not to stretch his knees so that they could mend. Durga's older sister, whom we interviewed, corroborated his account of his apparent death and revival. Durga's sister and a neighbor noticed a few days after he revived that marks had appeared on his knees. There previously had been no such marks there. These folds, or deep fissures in the skin on the front of Durga's knees, were still visible in 1979. There was no bleeding or pain in the knees other than the discomfort engendered by Durga's following the instructions to keep his knees in a fixed position. X-ray photographs that we had taken in 1981 showed no abnormality beneath the surface of the skin. So here we've got a case where a person is sick with typhoid, a very serious disease. He seems to die. His body gets cold. Then he revives. He tells that 10 people had taken him to where they looked at his papers and then said he was the wrong man, take him back. But this thing happened with cutting off his legs and putting them back on. Then when he revived, he recognized them. He looked through several pair. And mind you, this definitely happened out of the body, right? Because his body was laying on the bed. I mean, obviously his body was not undergoing this. But then the grooves appear in his knees. So there are many cases like this. These were collected by Ian Stevenson. He has about 16 cases like this from India. He says this is quite common. I'll give you one more example. Let's see, this was a man named Mongal Singh. In about 1978 or so, he had this experience. "I was laying down in a cot when two people came, lifted me up, and took me along. I heard a hissing sound, but I couldn't see anything. Then I came to a gate. There was grass, and the ground seemed to be sloping. A man was there, and he reprimanded the men who had brought me. 'Why have you brought the wrong person? Why have you not brought the man you were sent for?' The two men who had brought Mongal ran away, and the senior man said, 'You go back.' I saw two pots of boiling water, although there was no fire or firewood and no fireplace. Then the man pushed me with his hand and said, 'You had better hurry up and go back.' When he touched me, I suddenly became aware of how hot his hand was. Then I realized why the pots were burning. The heat was coming from his hands. Suddenly I regained consciousness, and I had a severe burning sensation in my left arm." So, it stated, "The area developed the appearance of a boil. Mongal showed it to a doctor who applied some ointment. The area healed within 3 days but left a residual mark on the left arm, which we examined. So in this case, the person who told him to go back burned him in the out-of-body experience, and when he got back, he had the burn on his body. Well, now this is relevant to UFO cases, because there are cases where people are abducted onto UFOs, and they will say that, well, I was taken on board the UFO, and I was cut in a certain way, and then it turns out they have a scar on their body, which corresponds to the experience that they had on board the UFO. So this is often taken as evidence that they really were physically taken on board the UFO, because the scar is there to demonstrate that. But here we have out-of-body experiences in which different kinds of scars are produced, but evidently the person's body didn't go anywhere. He just had this experience. The basic conception behind all of this, then, is that you have something on the subtle platform which can generate gross effects. In the case of the UFOs, there's every indication that these are some kind of manifestation produced from a subtle platform. Various lines of evidence would tie together to indicate that. For example, they're seen to appear abruptly. Typically, when they leave a place, very often they just vanish. They just blink out, as it were. The beings associated with them do the same kind of thing. They appear and they disappear. It's as though they were practically visions or images that were generated instead of physically real things. When they fly, they don't produce sonic booms, for example, even though they greatly exceed the speed of sound. This engineer who told me about a sighting he had on a military base, namely the China Lake Naval Ordnance Testing Range in California, China Lake. He was observing a military plane coming in for a landing. This UFO was flying along beneath it, and he said in the blink of an eye it flipped up to the wing of the plane and traveled about 300 feet in just a flash like that, and then continued along. So it was though it was a non-physical thing. And yet at the same time, you have these physical effects, including just like that metal sample. Then there are the stories of the dead bodies, which are pretty much gross physical. All the wreckage found at Roswell, which is another whole discussion which I mentioned last time. Ground traces in some cases, for example, the Valensole case that I mentioned last time. The dent in the earth looked as though many tons of pressure would be required to produce it, and a temperature of about 600 degrees centigrade was indicated. And this was investigated by French scientists who are quite reputable, and they admitted that some phenomenon, they wouldn't say what they thought it might be, but some unusual phenomenon must have done that, whatever it may have been. So you have grossly physical effects. So this corroborates, in basically, the Vedic conception, where we find that subtle energies produce gross material effects. And in fact, that's our basic understanding of the creation of grossly embodied living beings. The gross bodies were produced from subtle bodies by deliberate transformation, by beings on the demigod level. And this, in fact, has happened not just once, but many, many different times. One example where clearly this had to happen, although it's not explained exactly where it happened in the sequence of events, would be the case of Maharaj Ikshvaku and the dynasty that he founded, because his grandfather was the sun god, Vivaswan. So certainly the sun god has a body quite different from earthly bodies. So his son was Vivasvata Manu, and his son was Ikshvaku, but he lived on the earth as a human being, but not exactly like a human being like ourselves, because he was in Treta Yuga, according to the Bhagavad Gita purport, and lived for a very long period of time and had various mystic powers, But then generation by generation, you have kings descending from him. And of course, one thing to realize is most of the descendants in these royal dynasties did not become kings, because only the eldest son could become king, and all the other children had to do other things, and they in turn would have children. So whole countries are populated by their descendants. For example, from Maharaj Yayati, the Yavanas are all descended, which should include us, most of us. So the point then is, these are all descended from the sun god. So at some point, presumably going from Vivasvan to Yayati, you have the generation of gross material form from subtle material form. And in fact, what you would find is that at the stage where that takes place, the beings have the power to produce and eliminate material forms practically at will. That's shown by this example of Kardama Muni and so forth. So I've got one more example here. What I wanted to do was give some examples from literature of Krishna consciousness similar to what I've been giving in the UFO cases. So Satyaraj has that book about Narottam Das Thakur and Shyamananda and Srinivasacharya. So in all three of these cases, you have similar phenomena. In these cases, though, instead of going from subtle energy to gross energy, we would understand that you're going from transcendental energy through subtle to gross energy, based on the kind of examples that are occurring. In one case, Narottam Das Thakur would regularly meditate on his transcendental lila as a gopi serving Krishna. And it's explained that in his action as a gopi, in his meditation, he'd be boiling milk for Radha and Krishna. And the milk would sometimes boil over. So he would sometimes burn his hands when he was trying to grab the pot and adjust it so that the milk wouldn't boil over. But when he came back from his meditation, his hands were burned. Now, let's just go to ordinary stigmata, okay? Here's this classic case. A Catholic nun is meditating on the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. She's meditating on the nails driven into his hands and feet, and her hands begin to bleed, and her feet also, in just the right places. And not only that, guess what? This one I really liked. I don't know if this is true, but this is what I read. This one nun, the wound that would begin bleeding on her hands was square. The Roman nails were square, not round like our nails. Somebody noted this point. But never mind that. Let's just leave that aside. The point is that when she meditated, the wound would form and bleed. Now, let's explain that in terms of the nervous system. Okay, there's the brain. Nerve cells are firing. Somehow in the brain, an image of the crucifixion is being registered in terms of a pattern of nerve impulses. Nerve impulses go streaming down the nerves. They go streaming down nerves to the arm. But what is there at the hand level for the nerves to act on that would cause that wound? There are cells, but there are nerve endings that go to the muscles. There are nerve endings that go to sense perception units, like Pankian corpuscles and other little gadgets that sense pain. Those are afferent nerves. The impulses go to the brain. Going to the hand, the nerves, well, you can dilate the little muscles in the blood vessels of the skin. That's true. That explains blushing. When you blush, you dilate the blood vessels and more blood flows and it turns red. But we've got to have the thing breaking open and bleeding in a localized area. How does it do it?
An extreme form of blushing.
Well, not only is it an extreme form of blushing, but it's localized. Localized. How does it work? I don't think the scientists have an explanation of how that works in terms of the mind, if you look at it as the brain. On the other hand, if mind is some kind of energy that can operate by transforming the ether and so forth, then it could do that. So I'm giving one broad Vedic explanation for this whole category of phenomena. Now, I deliberately started with Narottam Das Thakur because that's an easy one. All he did was come back with burn marks. Ah, psychosomatic. Let's go to the next case. This is Srinivas Thakur. So Srinivas is meditating also. As Srinivas served the Lord in this way, in his meditation, he was sitting there meditating, he could not keep his composure, and looking at the Lord's magnificent form, he began to exhibit ecstatic symptoms. This pleased Lord Chaitanya, who then took the same garland of flowers that Srinivas had given him and placed it around Srinivas's neck. Now, when it's said that Srinivas gave Lord Chaitanya a garland of flowers, that means in his meditation. He was meditating on giving Lord Chaitanya a garland of flowers. So in his meditation, Lord Chaitanya took off the garland and put it on his neck. After the Lord made this loving gesture, Srinivas's meditation broke, but the garland was still adorning his own chest. Its fragrance was unlike anything he had ever experienced. So now, this is getting a little more psychosomatic. We have psychosomatic garlands. The scientist, of course, has an easy explanation for this one. It never happened. So, the one is believable because, after all, you believe such things, right? The other one is not believable, so that didn't happen. But notice the correlation between that and these other phenomena that we've been talking about. Now, the final case here was Shyamananda, who was known as Dukhi Krishnadas. And he had experiences fairly complex. The brief rundown of the story is that he was sweeping the area of Radha and Krishna's Rasa Leela in Vrindavan. And he found this ankle bracelet or something of Radharani, so he thought it was. And he hid that. So then this old lady came to ask for it. Said, "My daughter lost that here. Did you happen to see it? You sweep here every day." And he was a bit suspicious that this wasn't an ordinary old lady. So he interrogated her to see if she really had such a daughter and, you know, see if she really came there and so on. Finally, the lady revealed herself as Lalita, one of the principal gopis, and was extremely beautiful. And Dukhi Krishnadas gave her the bangle or whatever it was, and she marked his head with this tilak, which apparently became permanent. That then created a serious problem with his guru, who said, "Well, what is this? You're getting a new kind of tilak. You've taken a new name, namely Shyamananda." She gave him that name. And, you know, "I didn't do this. This is guru aparad." So he got into real trouble. And he had to convince his guru that this really happened. And his guru didn't believe a word of it. "You know, telling me these ridiculous stories. This is some dream that you had. And we don't accept this." So finally he made this arrangement. Well, to make a long story short, the arrangement was made that, I guess if the names of the Lord or something would be written on his chest, and if that could be washed away, then that would prove that he was saying something false, and if it couldn't be washed away, that would be proof that it was true. So he went into meditation and met this Lalita in his meditation this time, and she said, "Okay, you can make this proposal." And then sure enough, they weren't washed away, and finally his guru became convinced that this was genuine and so forth. That's cutting the story very much short. But anyway, the point is there, you have activities apparently on this gross physical platform and on a spiritual platform involving the same personalities. So you have things switching back and forth from an apparent gross manifestation to a subtle or spiritual manifestation. So in any case, the thing that I'm proposing in all of this is that you have a whole class of phenomena in which you can see the common themes run through them. It's a similar pattern of events that run through these different phenomena. This is true of the Vedic examples, of various kinds, such as the ones I was just mentioning, and also production of the animal forms by the demons in Krishna's pastimes, production of aerial flying palaces, and so many different things. And then in the case of the UFO phenomena, you have, on the one hand, apparently very strong gross effects. In other words, physical machines appear that sometimes leave wreckage, which completely puzzle an IBM scientist, assuming that he's giving honest testimony, and I have no reason to think that he's making it up. So there are these physical effects, or wreckage littered across a field at Roswell, or whatever the case may be. But then at the same time, there are these subtle energy effects involving out-of-body experiences and so on and so forth. I'll mention one last story. I mentioned that Indian-style out-of-body experience where the fellow was burned by the man in the experience, and then when he came back to consciousness, he had an actual burn on his arm that was treated by a physician. There's a UFO case like that, in which a woman was abducted onto a UFO somewhere in New Mexico and underwent horrific experiences. And this ostensibly was completely physical, but in the course of the experiences, this big boss man came and said, she was not supposed to have been taken. You must take her back. And then he touched her head with his hand, and her head was burned because his hand was extremely hot. Then finally, after more horrendous experiences, she was finally taken back. I don't know about that. She got a severe vaginal infection as a result of other things that were done to her. People have often asked, well, what is the meaning of all this? Why are these things happening in this way? And so forth. And you can say that for all of it, including out-of-body experiences where somebody meets some glowing being, and knowledge is transferred to them, and they come back and they can't remember any of it. The UFO cases always seem elusive. You know, like they fly around over Mexico City and everybody videotapes it, but then they're gone. So why didn't they, you know, land on the White House lawn and hold a press conference and, you know, explain everything? So things seem to work in that way, one can basically say, on these subtle energy platforms. Experiences seem to take place in this way. It seems to be a basic feature. After all, look in the case of Krishna's pastimes. You know, why in the world take these ridiculous animal forms and go fight with Krishna? That in itself is strange. Of course, different interpretations of the meaning of those forms will be there. But you can also ask that, you know, why didn't they just, you know, sneak in there at night and knife him or something? Or, you know, something more prosaic like that. Or there are so many ways of killing somebody. Not that you have to run into the village as a bull with a cloud hovering over his tail and cause everyone to have, you know, all miscarriages and all the pregnant ladies and so forth. But then again, another whole point to make is just because we do things in a particular way in the context of our culture and our abilities and powers, if you had completely a different abilities and powers and a different cultural background, you might do things quite differently. I mean, that has to be considered. I mean, to somebody else, automobiles may seem like a very strange thing. In other words, why do that? You know, pollute all your air and travel for hours to work at the risk of life and limb when people used to live, you know, right next to where they worked. You know, why do such things? So what we do also can be pretty strange. The basic conclusion, I've given a brief overview of some lines of evidence. And there are many other examples illustrating the same basic points. These indicate the production of gross forms of matter starting from a subtle level by intelligent beings. That would be the basic theme behind all of these examples that I'm giving. This is a basic theme in Vedic literature, and in Vedic literature it's explained how these things work in terms of subtle energies and so forth. By the way, before I forget, let me read this verse in the 11th canto, which is interesting in connection with what I've been talking about here. It is said here, "The yogi who completely absorbs his mind in me," Krishna is speaking, "and who then makes use of the wind that follows the mind to absorb the material body in me, obtains through the potency of meditation on me the mystic perfection by which his body immediately follows his mind wherever it goes." Now, think about that for a moment. So, there's a wind that follows the mind. Something to do with the air element. So, by manipulating that wind, if you know how to do it, you can make the body travel to wherever your mind goes. That means, in practice, if I could do this, according to what Krishna is saying, in my mind, I could go to Vrindavan right now. Zhip! My body would follow, just like that. And I'd be there. And I'd be gone from here. That would be pretty amazing. But that's, according to Krishna, that's one of the mystic powers that can be developed. And these are explained. So the basic idea is that in the Vedic literature, these processes by which subtle energy can produce gross energy in complex forms by the power of higher intelligence are described. In Vedic literature, there are many examples in which this happens. And we see that in these different examples, such as the ones of Shyamananda and Srinivasacharya and so on, plus in the Krishna book and throughout the Bhagavatam. Now, okay, that's Vedic literature. And someone could say, well, this is mythology. These are the stories of a religion. But in the empirical domain of things that people observe, we also see phenomena of this kind. At one end of the spectrum, you see mild phenomena, like the stigmata, or what may have happened with this lady's burn. And people will say, just mind over matter, but if you really think about it, you can't explain it in terms of the brain, the nervous system, the hormones. It really doesn't work. Then there are more extreme phenomena. It's one thing for the burn to heal up, and maybe it did have something to do with their ceremony. Then there are more extreme cases, say where the guy's hip bone totally reconstructs. Many other examples of the varicose veins of that carpenter. You know, 30 years of incurable varicose veins and his leg looks like a bunch of just a mess. And then it's okay. It's put back together again. So many examples are there of this kind of thing. So that's more extreme. Then, with these UFO phenomena, you have a whole gamut of experiences that people report in which the subtle and the gross seem to practically interchange. Is it a gross experience or is it a subtle experience? It's hard to tell. Wounds or scars are produced which make you think it might be a gross experience, but then out-of-body experiences can generate similar wounds and scars. But at the same time, then, you have really gross physical phenomena. Like the UFO itself is a very gross physical thing, it would appear. At least they can leave very gross physical marks and so forth. People photograph them with their Sony camcorders over, you know, Mexico City and so on. So the basic point, then, is that these phenomena seen empirically corroborate the basic Vedic picture. They're similar kinds of phenomena. They seem to work in similar ways. So if you take the Vedic picture as a hypothesis, as I mentioned before, then this empirical data backs up that hypothesis, or it corroborates that hypothesis. On the other hand, none of this empirical data makes sense at all in terms of the scientific picture. And in fact, within orthodox science, these things aren't accepted at all. However, there are individual scientists who do accept these things, like this Marcel Vogel, for example. And many other scientists have studied the UFOs and so forth. Of course, as soon as you do that, then that labels you as a person who would give credence to such kooky stuff. So This is the way the social processes work. But we do have a body of empirical data which corroborates the Vedic picture quite extensively. By the way, it fits that much better than it fits the extraterrestrial hypothesis for UFOs. That's the idea, you know, that they're flying here from another planet and they're completely gross and physical and they just have a high technology. But these subtle energy type things corroborate the more Vedic picture of what is going on.